Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. And today, I have no idea what we're going to talk about. Cody, what are we doing today?
I think we're just going to talk about the weather today, aren't we?
How is the weather where you are?
This is the worst. This has been the worst, my least favorite day of snow. Let me walk you through something for any non-Minnesotan type.
We're really going to do this. We're really going to start with a Minnesota weather forecast.
I'm so angry, Ben. I need to talk about this. So it rained like all day yesterday. And then that rain, because the temperature dropped, turned into just 5 inches of snow. I'm not exaggerating. 5 inches of snow. And you know what happens when like the wetness of rain mixes with the snow? It's like tossing flour. Like when you're cooking, it's like tossing flour into a liquid. So you get these heavy clumps. So it just becomes impossible to shovel and snow blow. So I had a good fight with my snowblower this morning, and I'm very, very unhappy.
Wow. It was windy here last night. Got into the 40s. That was a lot for us in California. Let's talk about some basketball.
Disgusting.
Now that we did a legitimate weather forecast to start the program. What do you think about Donovan Mitchell now that I think we're ready to have the discussion.
I think this might be the topic that we foreshadowed more than anything. Like, I think on the second time I was on here, you're like, we need to have that Donovan Mitchell conversation. And this is
So the Jazz had won 9 out of 10 games. Mitchell had averaged about 33 points a game in his 6 games heading into New Orleans on Friday. And I watched a ton of that game. It was some bad shooting from the Jazz. It was some nice defense from New Orleans. They sprung Herb. I mean, you got Herb Jones. You could spring Herb Jones on anybody. And then they played great. They played really well. McCollum looked really good in that game. And before you knew it, it was one of those things where I don't watch the scoreboard or care about it when I play. And before you knew it, you looked at the scoreboard and it was like 60 to 30. And you're like, wait, that doesn't even map up with what I'm seeing in this game. Anyway, that happened. They got blown out. And a ton of people were like, wow, that's really weird timing to make this video. And I'm thinking like, I've been making this video since December. Why do you think we keep foreshadowing? We're like, wow, we got to wait to talk about Mitchell. Somebody on the Jazz gets hurt. Somebody gets traded. They have had the best offense in the league the entire season. And I think because of where they play, who they are, the state of Utah, a small market, Rudy Gobert being their best player for so long. I'm no longer convinced he's their best player, by the way. I think they get slept on heavily because a lot of people were surprised. Like, I think there was cognitive dissonance when people either saw the title or started listening to stuff happening in the video, and they were like, Utah stinks in the playoffs. It's like, well, one, that's kind of a tautological definition, circular, to say only the teams that make the finals and the conference finals are good in the playoffs. I mean, we talked about a couple weeks ago, the teams Utah was losing to and playing somewhat competitively were like the 2017 Golden State Warriors, the 2018 Houston Rockets. But what's more interesting to me, and one of the reasons I ended up making this video and have wanted to talk about this all year, is the Utah Jazz offense in the last two seasons and their playoff offense going back to the bubble has been ridiculous. Like, offensive ratings in the 120s. I think last year their final team offensive rating in the postseason was like 121 something, according to the way Basketball Reference calculates possessions. And I mentioned it in the video with Mitchell, his offensive rating on the court in the last two postseasons is 125. There's maybe like a player or two for the Clippers, I think, that is over that. And some of that is because the Clippers played the Jazz in that series. But it hasn't been the Utah offense that's been the challenge in the postseason. It's been the Utah defense.
Well, let's talk about that offense for a second. I want to ask you about the numbers. So when we think about the transition from regular season to postseason offenses, number one, in general, what kinds of changes do you see between a regular season team's offense versus their playoff offense? And then number two, how does that map onto what you've been seeing from Utah's offense these last couple of seasons?
What I look for in the structure of an offense, or the diversity of the offense, the number of counters they have? What do you mean?
I mean, I think that could all feed into that, but how do they perform? Because you can see like strong regular season numbers, and there's always a conversation like, this is a strong regular season team.
Yeah.
But is there some kind of a change for most teams for like how well their offense looks or how good their offense looks in the regular season, especially numbers wise, versus what it might look like in the playoffs?
Oh, I see. Yeah, I mean, I don't think for most teams, there's some huge difference between the regular season and the postseason, because if you succeed and create a point differential and an advantage against opponents with your offense, when you get to the playoffs, typically you're still a good offensive team. Now, maybe what you're asking about is, are there teams like, I don't know, the 2009-10 Cavs or something, where you're built around LeBron, and then in the regular season, it's fine to have Mo Williams, J.J. Hickson, they brought in Antoine Jameson in the 2010 season. You know, does that stuff, Delonte West, does that work well in the postseason and the regular season, and then you get to the playoffs and it doesn't work well in the postseason? I think there's plenty of examples like that. And they're, to me, they have to do with counters. They have to do with someone says, okay, you've got LeBron, and we need to find a way to take away some of LeBron's advantages and then force other people to beat us. Or we'll let LeBron do what he's going to do and force other people to beat us. And I think that's where you can see a difference between a regular season and a postseason offense. When I see great success in postseason offenses, it's usually, oh, there's a lot of skill out there. The way they create the advantages is to hard to take away. And if you take them away, they have other things they can go to. And I think that's what's compelling about Utah. Now, they don't have Ingles anymore. Ingles is probably aging out anyway. He's not the same player he was two seasons ago. But, you know, great shooter, good passer, good extra passer. He can run some of the actions they run. But Utah has a ton of shooting, multiple ball handlers out there at all times. They have a ton of weapons. And when you look at Mitchell specifically, this, to me, goes back to that idea of a physical advantage. Michael Jordan had it. Derrick Rose has it. Ja Morant has it. It's one of the reasons why I'm so compelled by what I see from Ja Morant. When we did the point guard rankings, I had him very high because of this specific thing. When you get in the playoffs, you can put the best defenders in the world in front of Donovan Mitchell, and he's still like 98% as effective on the things that he wants to do. And I think that's where, if your offense is built on the backbone of that player, relying on it for success, and that player can still get the things they want in the playoffs, they're probably going to have a pretty good playoff offense.
And the thing that's really interesting about Donovan Mitchell, this was a conversation I had back when I was on Sense and Scalability. We called it the wrong initiator, and we had this idea that maybe Donovan Mitchell is not the quote-unquote correct initiator for a strong offense, right? He's not the kind of guy that you can give the ball and be like, create like a high-level offense on your own. And the Utah Jazz is kind of the perfect ecosystem for somebody like that. I don't necessarily know if that is the case anymore. I want to have a conversation maybe about his passing and how that fits into that conversation. But when you think about that team's construction, Utah basically has, I don't know, two or three, maybe three all-star level offensive players on the team, or at least sub all-star level offensive players. And when you think about how they're all together, like Donovan Mitchell is able to attack so much space. Players can't help off defenders because there's so many shooters and creators. And with Donovan Mitchell's developing strength and athleticism in the way that he attacks, I completely agree with what you're saying. Like, I don't see how you can stop him when you have the ecosystem surrounding him that Utah has.
Okay, here's the thing. Let's say I told you I can get you the best offense in the league by far, and in the postseason, you'll be dealing with offensive ratings around 120 or higher. I think most people would hear something like that and go, this is phenomenal. This is ideal. Any players I can put in that ecosystem to get me to that height, whether it's Steph Curry or LeBron James, or just get me there, that's incredible. I think that's what you have with the Jazz. And what's fascinating to me is Mitchell helps you get there without being the guy who runs 75 pick and rolls and all these heliocentric possessions, just spamming spread pick and roll or switch hunting or things like that. I think we've become too accustomed to heliocentrism. I think it's almost like we have helio brain. That's what it feels like. And we look at these guys, we look at these small guards especially, and we say, well, I don't know. I don't know if he can compete with Trae Young, because I can see Trae Young, I can just run 75 straight pick and roll possessions, and of course he's fantastic at hitting all the reads. He can hit the corner, he can manipulate the help defender, etc., etc. And Mitchell is not at that level as a passer. But I mean, just as an aside, his pick and roll efficiency is better than Trae Young's pick and roll efficiency. Now, some of that, of course, is because he's playing in this ecosystem in Utah. And if you swapped in Trae Young, the numbers would look different. But if you swapped in Trae Young, they would be running a different offense. And what I'm saying is, I think we are becoming a little too drunk on trying to evaluate these small guards by saying everything has to be in this cookie cutter 75 pick and rolls a game, spread pick and roll reads. And I want this guy to average 33 points, 16 assists, and 7 turnovers every game. Versus Mitchell, what I saw on the tape and what I've seen over the season is he's got more movement than you would expect. He's got more catch and shoot than you would expect. I love those plays that I include in the video where he just spaces wide, catches the change of side swing pass, and attacks like it's a closeout. Those are his skills. Quickness, first step, get in the paint, kick out. And he can do it within the quote-unquote flow of the offense while also being the guy who is the best pick and roll initiator both early in the clock and late in the clock. And to your point, no, he can't pass like LeBron James or Luka Doncic or Trae Young or Magic Johnson or any of these players. But, I mean, neither could Dwayne Wade. And Dwayne Wade was a good passer, and Dwayne Wade could run pick and roll. But you could also use Dwayne Wade in other situations. He's a great cutter, you know, these handoff actions. I love the way the Jazz have these. That's why I highlighted the three-man kind of stuff that they run, because you can have multiple shooters and ball handlers in these actions with the big. They like to play Gobert or Whiteside, the single big, and then have that guy be the primary screener, and he can go back and forth between these two. I'm going to flare, I'm going to run double screen, I'm going to run stagger, one guy's going to pop, one guy's going to roll, and if you swing it back to the other guy, let's say Mitchell sets the screen and you swing it back to him, then Gobert flies back out and you get a pick and roll out of that action with Mitchell and Gobert. He's good in all these things. We talked about it with the shooting. 44% on wide open shots. Like, who do you think most people think is a better shooter between Devin Booker and Donovan Mitchell?
Oh, I would think it would be like 80-20 people would say Devin Booker.
For Booker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I think. And if you look at the numbers, it cuts heavily the other way. Like, just pull-up threes. Booker takes four pull-up threes, a little under four pull-up threes every 36 minutes over the last couple seasons, and he makes them at 32%. And Mitchell takes almost six pull-up threes, and he makes them almost 36%. And Booker's wide-open threes are like 40%, and Mitchell's are 44%. So it's just this impression of, you know, what are the skills that the guy has that fits in the mold that I have about a small guard in my head versus touch passing, extra passing, movement shooting, quick, really quick dynamic closeout attacks, or just swinging and going, playing in handoff action. That's what I like about it. And I think he's become, I mean, I'm a believer. I think he's one of the better offensive players now in the league.
I want to rewind a little bit and go back to heliocentrism for a second, because when you look at Mitchell's load and box creation numbers over the last few years, which is basically how much he's involved with the offense and how much he sets other teammates for shots. Starting in 2019, it starts increasing, like from 2019 to 2020 to 2021. But then from 2021 to 22, those drop a little bit. He actually has less of a load than last season. He's creating fewer shots for teammates in last season. He's scoring fewer points per 75 at this moment than he did last season. His efficiency is up by a solid almost 3 percentage points.
That's the key. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the key.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the key. And so I think it's really interesting. It looks like the Jazz realize that they hit this point where they're like, you know, if we're going to really take advantage of the skill set that Donovan Mitchell has, this 52 for his load, his offensive load, is probably about the peak for what is going to be good for him. So maybe we want to taper that back a little bit. So when we look at some of these numbers, I think my question to you, now that you've done this huge deep dive of Mitchell, is someone might really quickly look over the stats and be like, Mitchell seems basically like the same player as last year. What do you think, if anything, what do you think he is better at this season than he was last season, or at least even the last couple seasons?
Yeah, I think he's progressively gotten better from rookie year to second year, probably to third. So if you go back to the bubble, all this has happened very quickly because it's still kind of surreal. But we're in March of 2022, and the bubble ended like 16 months ago or so. I mean, so this has all happened in that time period. And I think in the last two seasons, especially for me, what I've seen is one, somehow increased athleticism. Like, his cuts are sharper. His movement is sharper. Two, to go along with that, his handle has clearly improved. I actually went back and in my old notes from the 2019 profile I did, fumbling was one of the, it's one of the little tags I use. If a guy gets a little loose on his moves, he's getting into the gap and people are getting their hands in a lot. He's making a spin move and he's losing it. He had more of those a couple seasons ago. His handle's tight now, Cody. It's legit. It's ridiculous. And it pairs with that movement. And then I think the shooting has continued to improve. When he came in initially, it wasn't that he was a poor shooter, but you had some questions, or at least I did, about the numbers that he started to put up on long twos and threes. And those numbers look beautiful in the last couple seasons. You add that together and then you get the passing. Because I do think he's improved steadily as a passer throughout his NBA career. And is he going to manipulate you out of pick and roll? No. But I think, well, I shouldn't say no. Like, he's just not going to do it at the same prevalence as these great maestros. But I think with him, you can see nice feel on the extra passes, the dynamic passes, the touch passes. I have one that I included in the video that I liked a lot, which I thought was representative of this, where they're coming down in transition or like semi-transition, and he realizes he has Bogdanović under the hoop with like a 60-foot chest pass. But before he throws it, he looks to the left like he's just going to casually... That kind of thing. And if you listen to him mic'd up in games, like when he talks to players, you know, I don't think he's Larry Bird out there, but he's a guy who's just got a feel for winning basketball, I think, that's a little better than he's given credit for. And I think that maps into his passing, where it's like, look at the way Utah likes to use those little three-man actions where then at the end, Gobert can dive to the hoop. Mitchell makes some gorgeous touch passes off those actions. Like, you got to understand in your head what's unfolding and what's happening and where the defense is, and you have to be a step ahead. And he can be at least a half a step, maybe a full step ahead. Ball comes to him, boom, you got a layup. That's beautiful basketball. And I really think we just tend to index too much with these small guards on spread pick and roll, and I want to see Ben. I want to see his offensive load at 70. Come on, get it up to 70. Like, I want him doing everything. And the reality is, you don't need him, and maybe you don't want a lot of players actually playing like that to have a great offense.
Especially when you have so many strong secondary and tertiary creators on the Jazz, like Mike Conley, you want the ball in his hands sometimes. Bojan Bogdanović, you want the ball in his hands sometimes. Yep. Joe Ingles, when he was there, you want the ball in his hands. And a couple of points that I have about Mitchell. One thing that actually jumps off the page for me is his pull-up jump shooting this season, especially from three, is the best that he's had in his career. Yep. His attempts per game has been going up, but his catch-and-shoot numbers are significantly down. He's never been below 40% on catch-and-shoot threes before this season. He's at a shade under 33%. And even with that dump-off, with shooting 3.5 of his threes off that catch-and-shoot, he's still almost 3 percentage points more efficient. So I don't even think we're seeing... Like, we're dealing with shooting volatility. I don't know if we're seeing as efficient as we could see with Donovan Mitchell. The second point...
Yeah, he could have a little bit more on his efficiency, still being at, like, 29 points per 75 volume scoring.
Exactly, which would just... Yeah, yeah. It would make him seem an even more impactful offensive player. My second point, for the thing that I think's really stood out to me for his main improvement for this season, and this is something I've seen with Jason Tatum, I've seen it with Jokic... I know there's another player I wanted. Oh, Paul George is another one. And we were talking about it with Manu Ginobili before recording here. And it's this explosiveness off unorthodox footsteps driving to the basket. And I think maybe 10 years ago, there was this fascination with like the very basic Euro step. Like you go boom, boom, like one to the right, one to the left, and you finish. But Donovan Mitchell is so good at like, here's a super elongated stride that's like twice as long as one. But I'm going to follow it up with like this really choppy eighth of a step one. You even pointed out in the video, like his back foot is literally dragging on the floor some of these. And he still has the strength and explosiveness to get up and finish around the trees.
He's a crazy athlete. He's one of these guys where I feel like if he played another sport, you would get an idea of his athleticism. Like if you had him try out for like a football team or something, you'd be like, whoa, that guy is off the charts as an athlete. Driving wise, the stuff you're talking about, I think this opens up a penetration game. And I was trying to figure this out. I wonder what you think of this. How many players in the world do you think are better at essentially breaking down defenses with quickness and ball handling. Not power. I'm not talking about like Giannis or LeBron or Jokic backing down, but getting those paint touches where you're crossing over, making one of these moves you're talking about, using quickness, getting into the lane, and then applying that pressure on the rim to score or being able to kick out.
So if we're combining actually finishing ability along with all of these things, it's a very short list. I think that the names that come to mind, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Ja Morant, Trae Young.
I think Mitchell is definitely better than Shai at that. I think he's better than Trae at that. I mean, especially when you combine finishing ability. We were looking at some finishing ability stats before the show. Can you pull those up as I kind of talk through this?
Yep.
And it's B-Ball Index that has a kind of finishing metric, I think, or maybe it's just a Z-score or something, trying to compare how far players are from the mean when you take into account drives, teammate spacing, team context, volume of drives, and efficiency finishing at the rim. And man, I mean, to me, it's like Morant and Mitchell, and I actually struggle to get a third guy currently. I mean, if we like went back in time, we could do Derrick Rose, and maybe we can circle back because I have some thoughts on how Derrick Rose fits into this. But I mean, Luka has great numbers and he's really good at it, but he does it in a totally different way. He'll back you down and be methodical and use his body, whereas I think Trey's size is a problem even after he makes that first move. Mitchell and Morant, those guys, I mean, if you're a 7-foot shot, if you're a great shot blocker, you can slow him down. But if he sees wings in there, if either of those guys see wings, they're just going to take it right to him.
I think this is one of those where, like, this might be a skill Ja Morant is in, like, a whole tier of his own. Like, his ability to self-create, get to the basket, and finish is, it's unreal. Like, it doesn't make sense.
The volume, like, the amount of pressure, I think in his video, I might use the word relentless or something. Like, he just constantly stress tests defense and then go. Like, he's looking for the gap and then goes. And if there isn't a gap, he'll wait and keep his dribble alive and go. Mitchell doesn't quite have that level of activity and pressure. I don't know if he could sustain that the way Ja does. But part of the point I'm making is, like, that's not the only way to run good offense. And especially when you're in an ecosystem that has different options, to be able to still provide value, movement, handoffs, plug in, close out attacks, I mean, cuts, whatever it is. Like, I think that is something that's maybe becoming underrated for the small guard specifically.
I like that. I like that idea. And another shout out for a player that's having a down year on this, but I think has the ability, is De'Aaron Fox.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, if you look at years past, he has this blinding speed, like one of the fastest players in the league getting to the rim. But the thing that Ja Morant doesn't have, De'Aaron Fox doesn't have, none of these guys have, is that pull-up jump shooting ability that Donovan Mitchell has. And I think he's more effective working off ball and getting involved with the offense. And I think all of those things together, I don't know if this is a hot take, does that make him a better offensive player than say, Ja Morant this year? Is he? I don't know.
Ooh, I think I do love the fact that he has the inside-outside combo, and he definitely has that over Ja. Ja, on the other hand, has, you know, rim finishing and rim pressure over Donovan, and I think Ja, this is a really interesting conversation that you asked about his passing. Ja's passing on ball out of those pick and roll actions or things like that, I think is better. I think his lay down game, like, in other words, taking all that pressure of collapsing the defense and then finding a big with a little drop off, dump off, wrap around, even maybe lobs, I think Ja is better at that. But, you know, is Mitchell a better extra passer? Is he a better movement player? Can you play him in more systems? He's definitely a better shooter. It's really interesting. It's really interesting because both of those guys, especially Mitchell, feel like they have a gear. You put them in a playoff series, you play against an elite defense, you need stuff to happen in the fourth quarter when things are tight and people are tired and intensity's up and you got timeouts everywhere, so they're coming out of the timeout every 2 minutes and the defense is like, here's what we're doing, watch this action. And that's where you need, okay, it doesn't matter what you say in the timeout because no humans can stay in front of Ja Morant. It doesn't matter what you say in the timeout because Donovan Mitchell's going to make 40% of his pull-up threes from God knows where all over the court. And yeah, that's where I think those guys are fascinating when you size up best offensive players and best offensive wings and guards in the league. Maybe we should have that conversation at some point in the future.
I think it sounds like a good one. And
that's a good teaser.
Comparing their roles, I know Ja Morant, the Grizzlies do a good job of using Ja Morant off ball. Like, they don't just spam like high pick and rolls like someone would with Trey. Yep. But just watching them, it feels like Donovan Mitchell is a bit more involved movement-wise, maybe intensity-wise, when he is off-ball than Ja. Not calling out Ja for that, but I just think Donovan Mitchell is a little bit better than that. But then on the passing side, that is something in Mitchell's passing game that I feel like I didn't see as much. Like, he made those great passes into the interior, especially off the secondary creation from the perimeter, but I didn't see a lot of those, like, drive in and then create a layup pass for somebody else, which is something that I feel like Ja had. And I think, these driving skills that we're talking about, attacking the basket, I just think that's so tough to scheme for when you're a defense. Because then you have to worry about, all right, we have these shooters, but we also know that Ja and Mitchell are going to be coming at us, and they're going to get to the basket. What are we going to do? And then that's just another thing that they have to strategize for.
I should point out that as great as Utah's shooting is around Donovan, Morant's shooting in Memphis leaves a lot to be desired. He's got Desmond Bain, but the rest of the team has not been a great shooting team. One thing they do well is the offensive rebound, and some of that is just personnel with someone like Steven Adams, but I think some of it is a guy like Morant just chopping the defense in half and then putting them in rotation. And so it's like, yeah, we kicked it out. Both Ja and Donovan stand out to me right now as almost preternatural kickout guys with their athleticism, because what they're doing is they're taking it an extra dribble, an extra step to the rim, to the big men, getting up in the air, and then knowing exactly where their bailout is, in the corner, to the top, whatever. And so they can push you super hard to the breaking point and then audible and go, I'll just take the open three with my teammate. And when you kick it out to Bogdanovich, it's going down most of the time. When you kick it out to, I don't know, Zaire Williams and Jaren Jackson and Kyle Anderson, even De'Anthony Melton, like, maybe it's 35% or whatever it is, but you can still get offensive rebounds off those actions. Heck, Ja's athletic enough that he can do it himself. Looking at, you had some cool stat in here, unassisted rim field goal attempts every 75 possessions. I love that we have that, by the way.
Yeah. Again, huge shout out to Basketball Index, that just, they have such a strong, like a huge bevy of statistics like this sort of thing. So that's where we're getting a lot of this information. And looking at these unassisted rim field goal attempts per 75, like, again, Ja Morant is in a league of his own. He's taking 7.3. This is out of every guard in the NBA. I don't remember. There's like 89 of them that's played at least 1,000 minutes. He's the only player that's above 7 per 75 possessions. He's the only player, he's the one of two players above 6. And it might shock some of you to find out that Russell Westbrook is number 2, but his finishing leaves a bit to be desired. And then Donovan
leaves
Mitchell
leaves a lot to be desired.
Just a little bit. Donovan Mitchell is down to about 8, with he's averaging about 4.3 unassisted rim field goals. So there's like a 3 attempt gap between those two.
Yeah, and a couple other names in there. Anthony Edwards, who's a much bigger body and obviously an absurd athlete, he's up there at over 5. Here's a surprising one for me. Malcolm Brogdon, also over 5. That I don't know if that caught you off guard. I did not expect to see Brogdon with that level of rim volume.
It didn't catch me off guard, because I always saw that when he played for Milwaukee, and that's why I was so sad when he left, is because they kind of had this really quick guard that could get to the rim and kind of spread out for Bud Ball.
Right, but to put this volume in perspective, Westbrook is finishing at 56% on his rim field goals this year, and Mitchell is at 65% on his rim field goals. And hold up, Cody, are you sitting down? Buckle up. Ja Morant, despite the absurd volume, 7.3 self-generated rim field goals every 75 possessions, and overall, it's almost 9 rim field goal attempts every 75 possessions. He's shooting 67% at the rim.
So that's what you said for Donovan Mitchell, isn't it?
No, he's 65.
Mitchell's 65. He's better than Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah, he's even better. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even make sense. This doesn't even make sense.
And this is where it gets interesting to me, because I think this, in many ways, is the weakness of someone like Trae Young. I don't even know if it's fair to use the word weak here, but when you stack him up against some of these guards with this athleticism and ability to kind of play bigger than they are, especially when it comes to high value real estate around the basket. Young is someone who actually isn't that good at rim finishing. He's 58% on about 4 unassisted attempts every 75 possessions. And so does that take away a dimension or mean, you know, because he doesn't have 2 or 3 levels of the court to kill you at, that when you get in a playoff series, maybe certain defenders or defensive approaches could take that away? Whereas again, it feels to me right now like if I'm in a playoff series and I don't know anything else, I'm going to be betting on Ja and Mitchell to continue to find ways to have success for their team.
This feels like a take that like one of the TNT guys would have. So I'm going to try and make it more nuanced here. But I feel like if I'm in like the playoffs or that kind of situation, I want an offensive player whose game is predicated more on getting to the rim and opening up shots for other players, as opposed to a player that's predicated on like opening up a longer shot for themselves. Does that make sense?
I think that's true in the regular season too, though. I think if you're saying, do I go outside in or inside out? I think you're probably going to get more mileage, more resiliency in the long run from inside out, because that ability to collapse the paint just puts defenses in such a compromised position. And usually it's some physical advantage that gets you there versus just your just pure shooting skill or movement or screening action, off ball sets, X's and O's, things like that. So Morant, you mentioned Shea, Westbrook when he was younger had this, Mitchell has it now, Anthony Edwards might get it. You just have these physical advantages that nobody can stay in front of you. That's something that's going to be relatively consistent, I think, against most defenses. Now, defenses can build a wall. They can sag in if you don't have the right spacing. We've seen this for a long time, for at least a decade in the NBA, maybe multiple decades, depending on how you think about this stuff. And that's where having a great pull-up jumper becomes such a big deal. Yeah.
Yep. And that's the counter that Mitchell has right now that I don't quite trust Ja Morant with. Looking at the stats, I think there's one player I want to shout out. Actually, this really is catching me off guard. Cade Cunningham being number 10 on this list for unassisted field goal attempts per 75. That's for somebody that really doesn't quite have the burst of some of these other players. I find that impressive. I think that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's young, but he's big, you know, slightly different physical build. Luka doesn't have the volume, but he's got great finishing, again, because of that size, because of the way he does this. So, okay, so we stack all this up, right? And if you look at something like Second Spectrum, the way they chop up drive efficiency and pick and roll efficiency and things like that, they have this thing called, direct... I think it's when the play directly ends from the action. And so if you look at drives, Ja Morant, 18 direct drives per game. And Memphis on those possessions, that's a lot. Memphis on those possessions scores with an offensive efficiency of 105.6. Okay. Trae Young, 15 direct drives per game. And the Hawks on those possessions scored an offensive efficiency of 104.1. Where do you think Mitchell lands?
I mean, when we're thinking about both Morant and Trae, probably at least in that ballpark, like in that 105 range.
Okay, so Mitchell is slightly lower, again, lower on the volume because he's not handling quite as much, I don't think. But he's just under 13 drives per game, and his drives end up with an average offensive efficiency of 110.5.
Wow. And when you say direct, like, that means that drives that Mitchell had that directly ended the possession, like either from a shot or...
I think a pass chain.
Okay.
So he drives, they kick it around, they get a shot.
Wow.
Hockey assists, I believe, are included in that. Let's do pick and roll efficiency. It's the same thing. Pick and roll efficiency. Morant runs 21 direct pick and rolls a game. 99.2 is Memphis's offensive rating on those sets. Trae Young, more of a pick and roll maestro. They run 28 per game in Atlanta. Offensive rating is just under 107. Mitchell, 19 pick and rolls a game. Utah's offensive rating on those is 109. So again, the ecosystem matters. These guys spacing around him matter. But I think, I'm really hitting on a theme here in real time, just off the top of my head, we do a disservice when we say, like, it's got to fit in this heliocentric pick and roll model. And it's like, no, you can be really good at running the pick and roll in your own way. You can be good at selecting and targeting and picking out your isolations, and your driving game, whatever you want to call that, attacking closeouts, whatever, switches or whatever, like, your driving game can be effective. You can put all those things together with your spot up shooting, with your movement shooting. And to your point, it will be interesting to see if at this point in time, where guards have had a really hard time generating high efficiency, we didn't mention that, there aren't many guards above like plus 3% efficiency relative to the league this season. So what does that get you under? Let's say 60%. 60% kind of becomes like a gold standard. It'll be interesting to see if Mitchell can have a full season if he's shooting a little better on those catch and shoot threes at around 60%. Because frankly, at this point, Cody, I think that would just be phenomenal for a small guard.
And this brings us back to the conversation about how often he's creating, like the fact that the Jazz brought back his creation a little bit, and instead they just get this much more efficient offense because of it. And this makes me think back to your, I think you have a chapter in your book, your Thinking Basketball book, about Wilt Chamberlain. I think you call it like global offensive impact or something like that. Yep. Where it's like, yep, well, look at Wilt, like, he's so efficient when he shoots, why shouldn't he shoot every possession? But like, this is the situation. Maybe you scale back some of that shooting, you get more better shots for other people to create, but you also get better shots and more efficient shots for yourself to create. And that's where my mind goes right away when I see these numbers. And Luka, 30 pick and rolls a game, 100 offensive rating.
Like, yeah, that's a lot of pick and rolls. Yeah. But Luka is killing people in the other areas, which is so fascinating because he gets these mismatches, he gets switches, he gets the right defender on him, he backs him down, he's methodical, and his ISO numbers are off the charts right now, Cody. According to the same second spectrum sort of categorizations, almost 10 ISOs a game at 111 offensive rating. That's not, just to put that in comparison, Devin Booker has about 5 ISOs a game, and the Suns' offensive rating on those plays is 89. 111, that's madness.
Off a really high volume, too. Like, double, yeah, basically, yeah, everyone else besides Trae Young here.
Yeah, and his drives, we mentioned it a second ago, looking at the B-ball index stuff, his drives are even more efficient than Mitchell. He's got 18 drives a game at nearly a 113 offensive rating on drives. So there are a lot of ways. I think the takeaway for me is that if you can be really, really, really good in a lot of areas, that can either be the same or sometimes even better than just being great in this one area. And that one area happens to be the thing that we all think of when we think of like small guards or lead guards. But I think having this sort of diverse attack is a key thing. And with Mitchell specifically, I think it makes him one of the better offensive players in the league right now.
Well, I think that's the same for both players and teams in general. Like, the best teams are the ones that have these secondary ideas for attacks, these tertiary attacks. This is why we love coaches like Eric Spoelstra, who seems to have counters for counters for counters, and this just makes them so much harder to stop.
Yeah, okay. So all this, I have one other thought I want to get to, if you'll indulge me.
Of course.
And it's that Derrick Rose thought, because I've seen a lot of people recently compare Rose. Have you seen this? People comparing Rose and Morant?
So much. It's been enticing. It's been a conversation that I'm like, man, this is an interesting question.
So Rose obviously won MVP. I don't think he was close to the best player in the league in terms of impact. He may have been close in terms of there weren't that many players that I would rather have in his 2011 season. I don't know what that number is off the top of my head. 6, 7, 8, 9. So he was really good. But he won one of those MVPs where it's like LeBron and Wade cancel each other out, and I don't know about Kobe with the Lakers and Dwight Howard. I don't know if I want to give it to Dwight Howard because it's Dwight Howard and there's weird stuff going on down there. And oh, Nowitzki, I didn't pay attention to Nowitzki because he's a choker and a loser and a European softy. You guys forgot that. You guys forgot that. That's all they said about Dirk Nowitzki before the 2011 playoffs. Nothing serious to see here. Move along. This team is a team of choke artists. That didn't turn out that well, man, obviously.
The post-2007 discourse around Dirk was like, yep, some of the worst stuff, yep, in retrospect.
Yeah. So that gets rewritten and erased, but I mean, it's happening today. It happened. We just talked about it, how, like, you know, Giannis was a problem and not in the good way until last year, when then Giannis became a problem in a good way. Then he's Giannis and like a top 20 player of all time. So, okay. Ja Morant, Derrick Rose. I hear them compared a lot. Here's my thought, Cody. Guys today can have very similar skill sets to guys in the past, even the recent past, like Rose, like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever it is. And they can have these similar skill sets. And you can say, well, Ja does this a little bit better. Or Ja is like Rose, but he also shoots more threes. Or his passing looks a little better. We've got spread pick and roll, and his assist numbers are higher, and yada, yada, yada. Memphis's offensive rating is better than Chicago's offensive rating. There's ways you can kind of look at this and talk yourself into Morant being, and I'm going to use this term very deliberately, being almost like a better version of Rose. And I think this is a trap because the same skills, you could almost do a thought experiment, the same skills that you have today, if you took them back 10 years ago, they might be more valuable 10 years ago. They might be more valuable on a certain team 10 or 15 years ago. Sometimes they're less valuable. And that's what's tricky, is that when you compare guys that are from not too far away in the course of NBA history, but the league circumstance has changed radically, you have to be careful about being like, oh, well, this is a better, newer version of Derrick Rose. It may be in the skill set sense, but within the league, and I'm, by the way, I'm not taking a side right now. I'm not saying one is better than the other. But within the league, that doesn't necessarily mean that 11 Rose wasn't more impactful and more valuable than 22 Morant. Even if you look at 22 Morant on tape and you're like, whoa, he's got the same things plus a decent three-pointer or whatever.
I think the trap here, the bigger trap, and being somebody that's in quite a few all-time drafts and seeing the way that people talk about old-time players and looking through stats and stuff, but you can look at the tape, but you can also just quickly scan Basketball Reference and be like, or even like other, like maybe even your back picks database and be like, wait a second, Ja's a higher load? Ja's a higher box creation? Ja yep. scores more? Ja has yep. a higher, is more efficient? Like,
yep.
Is Ja Morant just straight up better than Derrick Rose?
Yep.
And
no, but that's the trap.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. All those things. So that's a great point, because you can do it from like a skill set perspective, like what you're seeing on film or what you're seeing in highlights, and these things that pop, these kind of like salient points, crossover, penetration, first step, hang time at the rim. And then you go, oh, but Ja also has this step back three. Come on, they didn't even have a step back three 10 years ago. So Ja also has this step back three. And it's like, the thing that matters is relative to the league, relative to other guards. And Rose, with those skills, I would think it's not unreasonable. Again, I'm not interested in taking a huge stance on this, because I think they're both probably in the same ballpark as players, the way I would line them up. But to your point, you would also then look at the stats and you'd be like, well, wait a second, hold on. Ja's even more ahead in, you know, load, creation, scoring, efficiency. We just go down the line and he just looks better. But that doesn't necessarily mean he's better, because you got to remember, different skill sets will create different impact in different environments. That is true whether you're talking about going back in time, and it's true whether you're talking about changing your team or coaching or X's and O's within the 2022 season.
So, okay, here's my question. So we have these stats, we have these highlights we're watching. We have some person that's like, well, I was there, I was watching, Derrick Rose is better. Is there some kind of way, Ben, is there some kind of website that allows you to maybe go back and, I don't know, watch a full game to try and put together this context? Does that exist right now?
You're talking about a site that maybe you could watch like videos on your phone or computer or television, and then you would put that up and you'd be like, show me these 20 Derrick Rose games from the 2011 season.
Yes.
And you could pause them and rewind them.
Yeah. Like, how?
There's no way. That would be a great invention. I would buy stock in that.
You'd probably spend money on that. Like, I would pay like $20 a month for that service.
I would love it for free.
All right, we're done with this bit. So what I did, I was interested in this. Seriously, go, if you ever hear somebody that's like, oh, I was there, I watched them, go to YouTube, type in the year, type in the team. You will be shocked by how many high quality games you will be able to find. And so, you know, when I saw that James Harden was going to be out for the Sixers Heat game, I was like, well, I guess I'm going to go watch some Derrick Rose games from 2011 just to make sure. And Ben, the thing that really stood out to me, 10 years ago, this might as well have been 40 years ago. Like, the spacing of the Thibodeau Bulls in 2011, I'm shocked that Derrick Rose even had the offensive impact on his driving game that he was able to have in that ecosystem.
Right. So, I mean, it's a great example. Radical changes short period of time. Sometimes you can go 20 years and not have many changes, and sometimes in 10 years you have these radical changes, and you have very similar players athletically. And I think it's nice that it's a fair comparison because there's similarities between Ja and Rose, but of course it's probably mostly fueled by just like fast break dunks from small guards that look incredible. These guys have ridiculous hops and they're up in the air forever and just these beautiful highlights get, you know, you throw a lob back to your point guard in transition and he dunks on someone's head. Marcus Smart the other night we're all still recovering from that left-handed transition dunk that Ja had, but the environment's so different. The spacing is different. The shooting is different. And again, that might make it worse in terms of impact, but it also might make it much better. That's his skill set may have been super rare and therefore super valuable. And in his case, he was like playing on a defensive team. He was playing on a team where they're like, you know what lineup we should run out here, Cody? I would enjoy myself some Taj Gibson and Omer Asik in the front court. That's my front court. And if you're thinking, don't worry, we've got Kyle Korver coming for shooting. Let me just throw Ronnie Brewer out there as well. So we only have one shooter. We are good to go with one shooter.
So I have a stat about this that's comparatively to show you the sorts of teams that Ja Morant and Derrick Rose played on. So of the Bulls' top seven players by minutes per game in 2011, only two of them shot over 0.3 threes per game. One of them was Derrick Rose. So that means most of the players that Derrick Rose is playing with shot fewer than 0.3 threes per game. Okay, it was Derrick Rose and Luol Deng. All right, Luol Deng's not really known as a sniper. Kyle Korver wasn't even the top seven players in the rotation at that point. This year, of the Grizzlies' top seven players, only one is shooting fewer than 3.5 threes per game, and it's Steven Adams.
Yeah, well, he's got to be in there to pick up all the offensive rebounds. You need one guy to fetch the balls while you have shooting practice.
It's mind-blowing. Like, I get that they didn't necessarily have the shooting talent. They actually had, like, Keith Bogans could shoot some threes. Kyle Korver could obviously shoot some threes. But even in the way they set up offenses, like, at one point, there was this, I don't know, it was a pick and roll, or like an isolation. I think Derrick Rose had a high pick and roll, actually, a high screen and roll. And he's attacking on the left side. And the Bulls are stationing one player on the left side, and it's Taj Gibson. They put Taj Gibson in the corner. Okay.
In the corner, but is he even spotting up behind the line?
Yeah, he was, but he didn't shoot threes. So, like, what are you doing over there? And you know who's on the other side? The other corner? Kyle Korver, right? So Luis Scola, who's defending Gibson, is just like, all right, I'm just going to stand in the paint and wait for Derrick Rose. And it completely shuts off any driving ranges. Like, you could have just been like, hey, Kyle Korver, be on this side, space the ball out a little bit better, be on the strong side with Derrick Rose instead of Taj Gibson. It blows my mind how, like, spacing as a concept for so many teams and coaches has just, like, in the last few years is this revolutionary idea.
Yeah, a lot has changed in the last 10 seasons. Do we have any other topics we want to hit? I don't even know how long we've been talking. We've just, Mitchell, Rose, Morant, unassisted field goal numbers. I mean, I'm basically, it's like an opium trip. This is just...
That's one way you could say it. Out of all of the ways one could say it, that is one way you can say it.
Seems like the most appropriate.
Do we have other topics we want to talk about?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think we're going to have to table this top offensive players conversation. We're going to have to come back to that. That's kind of, now that we've teased Mitchell for a month and a half, that's going to be our next big venture to get to. And I mean, I need to see more games in Philadelphia and Brooklyn before I talk about those teams. And so there's nothing more to, I mean, we've talked about all possible basketball topics that one could talk about.
Yeah, all of them. That's it. For the record, I'll go on record since you didn't want to go on record. I think if you swapped them, I think Derrick Rose is probably a better player than Ja Morant. Not probably. I think Derrick Rose is a better offensive player than Ja Morant right now.
Okay. Oh. All right. Oh. That's fair. He was very good. He was very good.
Yeah.
And then it ended so quickly.
Yeah. So talking about that, do you want to talk about championship windows?
No. Let's leave it for another episode.
Okay.
If you want to support this show, head on over to patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. We actually might have some watch-along footage from that Bulls game we were alluding to earlier. We checked out a little Bulls Bulls Spurs from 2011 with Derrick Rose bringing it home in the fourth quarter for Chicago. We also have a bunch of other features. We just did our monthly Patreon Q&A. You can access that. We have a Discord community. Some of the stats we cite during the show are available that update daily on the website, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Check that out. Cody, that's it. Anything else we need to say before we get out the door?
You could also go back and still watch that 75 watch along we did. That's still there.
75 watch along. People are still talking about that.
It'll be there forever. Go check it out.
Well, I can't promise it'll be there forever. I do have the delete option, which I can exercise if someone finds out that I said something completely inappropriate. At the beginning, I had a long rant, but I had to edit that out. That was Cody's like, you can't. That's not. You can't have that on there. You got to take that out. So I just cut it.
Why are you saying?
Yeah. No, I had to take it out. It had to be removed. That is it. Thanks, as always, for listening all the way to the end of the show. And, of course, I hope you are having a great day.